Today, you can hear house prices falling. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, Tarek Brooker's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Very good. Now, the question is, if house prices are falling and nobody notices, are they actually falling?
Well, that's quite the question, isn't it? Because is it possible for housing prices to fall without nobody noticing? It seems like anyone can talk about at the moment. You know, you've even got the PM, you know, sticking his nose in where it doesn't belong.
Yes. We want to be careful the RBA doesn't overshoot. The RBA, who of course misled people last year in terms of rates not going up, and then are now saying, well, they might go up a bit and probably a bit more. Arbo's panicking.
He is. I mean, it's been a bit disappointing, really. I mean, he's only in his, you know, just into his third month in office. You know, the election was only a little over 2 months ago. And, you know, he really shouldn't be saying those things. And, you know, like, say, for example, you know, he says, oh, I hope they don't rise as quickly as, you know, or as much as, you know, ANZ are talking about. And they were recently revised their cash rate forecast to 3.35% by year end. So it's all really been a bit disappointing, you know, especially if you were expecting something different.
Well, just remember that ANZ's now just talking what the market's talking, right? And it's worth reflecting. Last November, when Mr. Lowe was talking about rates not going up till 24, the markets were signalling roughly where rates have now got to.
Yeah. Well, that's something that I talked about in an article in October last year. The market wasn't so aggressive at that point about raising, you know, rates rising so quickly. But I made the point that the RBA could end up like Wile E. Coyote from the old Looney Tunes cartoons chasing after the Roadrunner. In this case, the Roadrunner's role is played by inflation. And at the time, you know, the Low and all these other commentators are like, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen till 2024, end of 2023 at the earliest, yada, yada, yada. And now Lowe is cashing out all his money at Acme to buy whatever rocket he can get his hands on to chase after inflation.
And of course, the ECB did a 50 basis point rise overnight, right? Having signaled to the market 25 basis points, I think only four economists out of 58 or something got it right.
Well, the funny thing with the ECB is it's just like, oh, we're gonna raise interest rates by 0.5%. But we're going to do heaps more QE for these nations that need it under all of these sort of completely insane and not applicable in reality, you know, based conditions. It's just it's nuts. I mean, in some ways, I feel like in Europe, the best person to have on your team monitoring the market is a four-year-old who's really, really good at playing pretend, because that's what it's all about at this point,
and really good at colouring in.
Yeah. If you can colour in the lines, that's a real big plus. It's just ridiculous. You know, it's just fairyland stuff. You know, well, let's just pretend that this isn't the complete disaster that it is.
And of course, they've moved the rate to zero for the banks, so you know they're no longer going to be getting direct payment from the ECB. But of course, it makes it easier for the banks now to make more profit as well. So I mean, it's crazy.
It really is, and it just goes to show just how fragile things are around the world. You know, you've got all these things showing signs of stress, all these systems, all these nations. You know, it's all well and good to look at someone like Sri Lanka and say, oh, that could never happen in anywhere else. It's just an outlier. But I mean, you know, I'm not saying it's necessarily going to happen in the West, but in other developing nations, I think that sort of thing is unfortunately, you know, on the horizon if things keep going the way they're going.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot to talk about. Well, you've put some slides together. I guess we should get onto the slides, otherwise we're going to run out of runway, a bit like the RBA. But let's start with this one, because this is a lovely way, and these are brilliant, aren't they?
Oh, I quite like this one, because I can just imagine one of those little bulls being Aldo and Powell being replaced by Lowe. So, yeah, well, as usual, the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. And without further ado, we'll get into it. Our very housing price focused show this week. This one shows, I quite like this, because there's this sort of disagreement over whether or not New Zealand is a relevant bellwether for Australia and the rest of the world. Now, personally, I think it is. Now, there are obviously differences between the Aussie housing market and the Kiwi housing market. Say, for example, they've gotten rid of negative gearing for It's been grandfathered in to a degree for people who own existing properties, but you know, you can't do it on a new property. But the thing that's really interesting is that if you take housing prices in New Zealand and Australia from 2 months prior to their respective rate rises, New Zealand's prices kept rising after rates had risen. And in some cases, they started to fall over in certain centres but peak. But here in Australia, housing prices were already slowly rolling over in Sydney and Melbourne prior to rates rising. And with rates rising, those falls have only accelerated further.
Yeah, I think that's a very important observation. And, you know, there was already some suggestions of some sectors of the market going soft before the rate rises, you know, at the end of last year in particular. The other point it's worth just highlighting is that rate rises don't hit accounts, bank accounts of households immediately, right? So the May rate rise takes about a month to 6 weeks to actually start hitting people's accounts. In other words, the shock of those rate rises are now just being the hit. And that's why we're starting to see now prices fall quite fast, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, but actually in other places too. So there's a bit of a lag between them pulling the rate lever and the market reacting.
No, indeed. And we're seeing this even on, say, like, for example, on Twitter. You know, there's Cookie Boy and there's Power Power and people like that posting these price falls of properties. You know, and these price falls haven't really, you know, fed into the data just as of yet. And even if you look at things like some of the CoreLogic data on a suburb by suburb basis, there's parts of Sydney that are already down more than 20%, which is just, you know, for it to have occurred so quickly is really something.
Absolutely. And the other point, the S&P Global Delinquency Report came out for the first quarter. And there are some suburbs where delinquency rates are already more than 4% already. And that was, yeah, you know, that was before all of this stuff. So it's not looking pretty. But I agree with you. I think that New Zealand is actually a very significant forward indicator of what's likely to happen. And of course, in New Zealand, they're squabbling now about who's responsible. Everybody's blaming everybody else. Central bank saying, well, we did what we thought was right at the time. The politicians blaming everybody else. Nobody really wants to take responsibility for this, actually.
No, it's really interesting just where we're finding ourselves at the moment. You know, like, sentiment is shifting very, very quickly. And we're seeing a lot more stock on the market at this point. Like Edwin, you know, from his famous, you know, Monday property rants, was talking about it on Twitter the other day, that the number of houses for sale in Sydney is up 35% compared with last year. And I had been having a conversation with him just earlier today. And, you know, he made the point that one of the key drivers of prices going so high so fast was the fact that that stock levels were so limited as a result of COVID, as a result of vendors being concerned about having people in their homes and all those other different issues. So, it's going to be really interesting now because, you know, we're seeing high levels of stock and it's the middle of winter. Well, you know, what is it going to be like when we hit the normal spring selling season? And that's a point that even some people in the real estate sector more broadly have started to make.
Absolutely. And I will make one more point, and that is that as the pressures on households build, the banks are getting quite vociferous with regard to those who are in difficulty and what they should do about it. And they don't want to actually push people into delinquency because, of course, the bad debts then stack up and that looks bad. But they're really pushing quite hard to get those people to put their problems on the market and get out before prices fall further. I've had at least 4 or 5 people over the last week tell me about experiences they've had with various lenders where they've basically now had the heavy arm to say, your finances have changed. It's unlikely they're going to actually be able to help them because, you know, it's too far from where they were previously. Better to sell, get out while you can, because prices are likely to fall later. Very interesting dynamic.
Is this based on just purely on the fact that rates are rising, or is these people who have experienced sort of changing financial circumstances?
It tends to be a combination of things, but the rising rates are part of it, and the fact that the income growth is not there. So in some cases, they've had the situation where one of the two people in the household are unable to work at the moment, so suddenly their incomes have come back. But a couple of them, it was simply that the price cost of the mortgage has just gone up too much, and you know, they can't now make it work. And the point is, of course, is that people can borrow temporarily and put stuff on credit cards and those things, and if they've got savings, raid savings. And, you know, it's all about buffers, mate. We might come onto that in a second or two, I think, because there's a very important conversation to be had there. But for these, they've got no buffers, they've got no runway, they've not way out. And so the bank is saying, look, why don't you put the property in the market and do that? We'll give you enough leeway to be able to actually sell and get out, because that then means they don't have to actually report it as a bad debt.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you make an important point, just how easily people can get into trouble just based on rising rates without even having, you know, a change in circumstances. I mean, I did an article a few weeks ago. I'll send you the link and get you to put it into description, based on the increased repayment burden for people who borrowed more than 6 times household income. And you look at some of these numbers. I mean, I only went up to 8 times household income, but there are people borrowing 9 and 10. You know, that was covered by some financial counselors the other day on the radio. I believe it was on 3AW. You know, they were talking about people borrowing 8, 9, 10 times household income. And, you know, these people, while they may have been like relatively sort of keeping their head above water at, you know, 2% rates, you know, 2% mortgage rates, if we're heading to, you know, 6% mortgage rates, these people don't need to lose a job. They are already going to be in some very, very serious difficulty.
Absolutely. Well, the old rule of thumb that I keep quoting, over a 30-year mortgage, a 1% rise in the interest rate on that mortgage is a 15% increase in the principal interest monthly repayment. 15%, right? So if it goes up, you know, 2 or 3%, you're talking 15, 30, 45%. Now, most of the debt-to-income ratios were in Sydney and Melbourne very high already. And if you look at the amount of money that's going from a household to service the mortgage, it's often 40, 50, 55, or even now. So what they're basically saying is, well, you can pay for the mortgage. Well, but that's it. You can't pay for anything else.
Yeah. No, that's – and you, I think you make an important point there about, you know, that the increase in mortgage repayments. And I think – part of the issue as well is the fact that people have taken on these mortgages at these low bait rates that were made possible by the term funding facility. You know, you're talking about, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 year fixed loans at sub 2%, then coming off to a variable rate of, you know, 5, 5.5, 6%. You know, I mean, that's going to be even more than the 15% increase per percentage point. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be really, really quite painful for them.
Yeah, well, they have very little wriggle room, unfortunately, which so the banks are sort of partly right, but the banks were partly responsible, of course, for the problem. And what amazes me, Tarek, is how often people said, but the bank said I could afford it. So, you know, there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the bank is doing when they're actually assessing a loan.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, that's the case. And, you know, I think it's rather interesting now that all the banks are revising up their cash rate targets. So it's almost a little bit of the reverse, rather than, oh, hey, this is what you can afford, you know, based on the good times. Now it's just like, well, maybe you guys should be a little bit more careful when you're getting a loan. But unfortunately, it's all a bit too late.
Absolutely. When the borrowing power is down now about 20%. So typically, you know, you can borrow 20% less because rates have gone up already. So how many people have overborrowed? A lot of people. That's going to be a big problem. And that linkage then back to house prices is critical, right? So the availability of the credit and house prices totally linked. And as the RBA modelling itself shows, if you put the rates up, prices drop.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, just on, you know, you're talking about the number of people who've got themselves into these situations. You know, in that article I was talking about that I wrote a few weeks ago, just since the start of the pandemic, the number of people who've taken on loans at more than 6 times debt to income is roughly 250,000 people. That's, you know, it's not a small number of people who are going to find themselves in difficulty unless their circumstances have changed significantly for the better since they took out these loans.
Well, I don't know whether you're going to talk about buffers in a later slide, but if you are, good. All right, yeah. We'll come back to them, because I've got a rant on buffers. So,
all right. Well, we'll definitely get to that then. I'm looking forward to it now. Okay. Well, now while Kiwi housing prices may have held up a little bit longer than Aussie ones in terms of where they were in terms of their relative rate cycles, once they started falling, they really started falling. For the national market, national excluding Auckland and Wellington, all those markets are now falling faster than the US housing market did during the Great Recession. And in Wellington, prices are down 17%. And that's near as makes no difference a housing crash, I would say, considering how swiftly they're falling. And, you know, and it's not showing any sign of slowing down. All these ideas in the Kiwi press about, oh, it's only going to fall 10, maybe 12%. Yeah, good luck with that.
I guess the point there, Tarek, is that some people will argue, well, we have this massive run-up, so we're just coming back a little bit and we're still a long way higher than where we were before we started, right? But I'd say so far. my view is that the long-term trend may be this, but you're up here somewhere still. So the downside risk is huge.
Yeah, but indeed. It's really just... But I think part of the thing as well is because things did run up so quickly, and because, you know, we have seen this such explosive growth over such a short period of time, I really don't. I mean, some have argued, and I think they make this argument, you know, relatively well, that even if prices do fall by 20-25%, it's not going to do anywhere near the same amount of damage as if, say, prices had have continued falling another 20%. After they'd already fallen in 2019 and the market was weak, you know, it's because it's coming down from an elevated level. So a lot of people, you know, especially people who don't really sort of, you know, go on realestate.com and monitor, you know, the value of their house frequently, they're not really going to care that their house is worth what it was at the start of 2020. There's not the political impetus that there would have been if we were in the middle of a, you know, a more normal housing cycle.
I agree with that. And the other point, of course, is that if you look at the long-term ratio of debt to GDP or debt to income, house prices are still 40 to 45% over where they should be,
yeah.
Right? So we are way above normal, right? And the reason we're way above normal is because of ultra-low interest rates, ultra-easy lending policies and all of those things, and all the government stimulus packages, you know, home builder and all the rest of it. This was an engineered bubble. The question now, are we in an engineered fall or collapse, or is it a free fall? And that's, I think, too soon to say yet.
Well, it's gonna be interesting to see if they can manage to derive a distinction between the two, because, you know, once something like the housing market turns, and it turns aggressively, it's pretty hard to get to that to turn around, particularly if sentiment starts to get undermined. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of investors in particular, have made some absolutely huge, huge gains recently. And even if prices fall 10, 12, 15%, they could still walk away with a massive, massive payday.
Yep.
And I mean, I don't know about them, but I mean, if I was looking at something like that and I could walk away with the cash in my pocket, well, I'd be definitely considering it, particularly, you know, if there is, you know, higher rates out there. I mean, like, I've seen term deposits paying over 4%, you know. It's a pretty attractive sort of thing if you're moving towards that latter stage of your working life and into retirement.
Yeah, well, certainly the leading indicator from my surveys is that many property investors are now going through that process of, because the net returns, you know, not the gross returns, the net return after all the costs are now negative for more than half of the investors out there. So what it basically says, if there's no capital appreciation and I'm sitting on this capital wodge that ran up, I want to capitalize on that before things go worse. So that's one of the reasons why, again, listings are up.
Indeed. Now, this is the falling auction clearance rates from the time that the RBA raised interest rates. Now, they were already in a fairly sort of bad place in historic terms. They were already in well and truly in price fall territory, as shown by the falling CoreLogic index at the time, but they've fallen even further. And I think one of the really important points to make about this particular slide is that this is occurring within an atmosphere of falling volumes in both Sydney and Melbourne, where some weekends volumes are down 40% compared to sometimes over 40% with where they were this time last year, even though, if, for example, in Sydney was in the middle of lockdown last year and volumes were still higher.
Absolutely. And, you know, the local evidence here is that auctions are being cancelled left, right and centre. So it's quite hard now to find a property auction actually running right at the weekend. I used to sort of go around and visit the local ones. Almost now exclusively it's private sale rather than auction. And the other interesting observation is that those auctions that actually do go through, if there's a sale, it's well below what the expectation was just a few weeks ago. So whichever way you look at it, volumes, price, momentum, it's all pointing in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it's all changed rather dramatically.
Yep.
Well, we get to your rant, Martin. Buffers. Buffers. Now, this one is from Westpac. I thought it'd be interesting to start with one from the banks, and then we can move on to some of the ones from the RBA. And basically, it shows that 49% of borrowers are less than 1 month ahead on their loans, and almost 30% are just on time. So it's really quite interesting in that regard, because, you know, there are those people, say, for example, there's almost a quarter of people who are 2 years ahead on their loan, and rates could rise to, you know, the cash rate could rise to 3% and they just shrug it off and it's no big deal to them. And ironically, they're the ones who are going to keep spending. But for other people, for this, you know, 49% of the Westpac loan book, well, things could get challenging a whole lot more quickly in that regard, particularly after that 11% of borrowers who are on fixed rates, who are just, you know, not ahead on their loans after they roll off.
Yeah, and I'll make a couple of points. The first is that, you know, Westpac said roughly 70% of all of their households are ahead, right? But when you look at that distribution, well, most of them are only slightly ahead. There are a few that are actually more ahead. But the ones that aren't ahead, right, the ones that are on time, the ones that are actually paycheck to paycheck, that's the ones to worry about, because what it means is that they've got very little ability to be able to navigate the higher rates and higher and payments that are coming through. And this is quite consistent with my analysis, right? So I measure cash flow stress, right? And remember, I'm about 45% of households in some risk, because they're trying to balance paying the mortgage and everything else. And so they're actually hanging on, but only just. It's really consistent with what the numbers from Westpac show. So there is a problem here. There is a cash flow problem for many households. And this is before the latest rate rises have hit. This data from Westpac. And it does include mortgage offset accounts.
Yes, it does indeed. And I think that is really a key point, because that's something that people have been saying for a long, long time, because it's been, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it. Australia's different. You can't compare the data because we have offsets. And you look at this and you go, well, it's still not a pretty picture. And like some people said to me, but you know, people invest, and you know, rather than having their money in an offset account or paying or getting ahead on their mortgage. And sure, I'm sure that there are some people that do that, but I can't imagine that they are the norm. And I mean, you know, maybe I'm too old school. Maybe, you know, I'm too prudent, but you know, I think it'd probably be a good thing to maybe, you know, have a little bit of cash in your offset account or pay down, you know, get a couple of months ahead on your mortgage just in case.
Yeah, I have to say, if you look at that chart, I'm quite amused by this. It says, chart does not add up to 100 due to rounding, right? I just wonder how much rounding there is. Maybe that's the reason.
Well, onto the RBAs.
Oh, yes.
So it's... I think we'll actually start with the one on the right, because I think it really illustrates what an absolute just mess the RBA has created with the TFF and the fixed loans. I mean, the idea that you're going to roll off your fixed loan and 11% of people rolling off fixed loans are going to face a 60% or more increase in repayments at a 3.1% cash rate. Well, that's just nuts. And then you've got more than 40% of people who face a 40 to 60% increase in repayments based on a 3.1% cash rate as they roll off their loans. And that's huge. You know, these are massive, massive numbers that, I mean, I mean, would I be incorrect in saying that you wouldn't be seeing just that degree of an increase in repayments basically ever in Australian history? I'm trying to think of a precedent.
No, it's never been anything like this. This is just like the adjustable rate loan problem in the US before the global financial crisis, where you had a lot of people with very cheap loans and then the rates went up. It's that same sort of quantum that we're seeing here, right? And it's also worth remembering, of course, that the fixed rates are still going up a bit more. So there's banks put them up again. I'm trying to quantify that. 500 billion out of the 2 trillion is something like the amount that's going to be reset over the next year or so. And, you know, the data from the individual banks shows that it's literally the next 12 to 15 months where a lot of this actually happens. Just at the time when the variable rate loans are also going up. So whether you've got a variable loan, whether you've got a fixed loan for reset, chances are you're going to be paying a lot more. And not just a bit more, a lot more. Now, the question is, how many households can cope with this? And this is where this buffer thing really gets, well, I get very cross, right? So the RBA says, well, of course, people have all these assets, right? And so they sort of stack up all this, and then they say, well, this amount of liabilities is quite small. Yeah, but those assets aren't by people who've got mortgages, right? What you should be doing is comparing the assets and the liabilities of the people with mortgages, not everybody else who hasn't, because only one third of people have a mortgage. So one third of people have a mortgage, one third of people own their property outright, and one third of people rent in round terms, right? Now, if you look at the data actually within those with mortgage, I think there's about one third who are fine and will be fine and will be able to cope with all of this stuff, no problems, because they've got plenty of buffers and plenty of savings, right? Down the bottom, you've got one third with nowhere to go already, and you've got another third in the middle who are now scratching their heads thinking, what on earth are we going to do, because we know this is coming? Yeah. That 60% of households in the mortgage pool, right, is enough to really cramp growth, economically speaking. But,
well, that's what, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because if you look at the graph on the right, that's pretty much what it illustrates.
Yep.
Because you've got the people on the left who are fine. They're not going to see any impact really at all on their lives from rising from a 3.1% cash rate. Mm. And then there's the people on the right of the this is on the graph on the left with people on variable rate loans, where almost a third of people are going to see their repayments rise by 40% or more. With a 3.1% cash rate. So I think that illustrates it quite nicely.
Absolutely. The other point to make is that those people with the buffers who have no mortgage, right, they're sitting on lots of assets. How much of that is they going to spend, though? Are they going to spend much more than they're currently spending? Right? That's the really interesting question. They could still be there with significant assets, because the market, stock market's been quite high. They come back a bit. They're still quite high. Property prices are still quite high. Might come back a bit. The point is, you've got to look at the marginal borrower here rather than just the aggregate average, right? And I'm afraid that I found that whole presentation from the deputy governor really very disingenuous in terms of really not wanting to get to the heart of the issue, right? The data was not saying what she said it said.
Well, I mean, it's the classic aggregate argument. I mean, I mean, you and I have been talking about this for a couple of years now. I mean, it's like when Frydenberg was coming out a couple of years ago and saying, oh, look at all these savings. You know, that's going to be able to, you know, save the market. It's going to insulate borrowers. It's going to insulate households, blah, blah, blah. You know, first it was against the pandemic, and then it was against inflation, then it was against rising interest rates. But it's like, even if you look at things from the assets and liability side of things, right, you're like, really, it should be about, I mean, it's like what you say with your own surveys. It's about cash flow. You know, you could have the most expensive house in the world on Sydney Harbour, but if you don't have any cash flow, you're going to have to sell your property. You know, it really is that simple. So, yeah, I mean, but I will say one thing that does interest me about all this is that there is going to be those households that you said that are going to maintain their spending, that are going to be relatively unimpacted.
Yep.
And as you say, there are also those other households who own outright or who rent, who are also, you know, not going to be as impacted by rising rates. So it's going to be really interesting as we see, you know, further, as I think we'll see further evidence of the sort of K-shaped economy, you know, whereby there's going to be the people who are going to continue to spend, who are going to continue to get ahead, who are going to see these good quality, you know, wage rises in these, you know, sort of in-demand industries. And then there's just going to be everybody else who's going to, you know, sort of suffer what they must, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, it's a continuation of what we said some time ago about this bifurcation of society, right? A proportion of society that's doing really well, has done really well, and will continue to, and a proportion of society that is struggling and battling through and trying to actually work out what to do. Unfortunately, quite a few of those people were cajoled into buying property right at the peak by the government, right, when the rates were ultra low. A lot of those are the ones that actually are those marginal borrowers. And that's why I'm very concerned about certain suburbs where we're seeing very significant social pressures and economic pressures building now. And unfortunately, I don't see any get-out-of-jail card there. I don't see rates of pay going to rise significantly to be able to actually cover these additional costs. So this is a real problem.
No, and I share your concern on the sort of, you know, these selected areas, these selected suburbs, because, you know, these are the places where, as you know, so for example, with your data on mortgage stress, now these are the places where people are in mortgage stress. This is where people are going to have to tighten their belts. But the thing is it's about not only that, but it's about the knock-on effect. You know, in these areas, people tighten their belts, they spend less, businesses get less revenue, and then that just, you know, you get that you know, sort of downside feedback loop. And that's not going to happen as much, at least in the immediate future, in these other places that may even benefit in net terms from rising rates because of higher savings rates, because, you know, because the demographics are different and people are older and they own their own homes or they've got, you know, significant savings. So, you know, like you're saying, you know, you could see that real divergence between different parts of the economy. You know, I mean, it could, you know, it could be, you know, 20 minutes down the road, but it could feel like a completely different world.
Yeah. And just to give you a sort of a very real couple of examples, I was talking to someone the other day. I was talking about belt tightening. He said, well, I've already tightened my belt right to the end. There's no more holes in my belt, right? I can't tighten it anymore, right? And that is, it's really that severe. I was talking to somebody else who said, well, actually, I'm waiting for these distressed properties to come on the market. I've got plenty of cash. I'm going to go and buy them and I'll make hay. A really, really, you know, worrying contrast between those two groups of people, both of whom exist in spades, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think this actually leads nicely into this next slide, which basically shows that, you know, consumer confidence, excluding the initial sort of shock of the pandemic, is at near multi-decade lows. And I think this is just a theory. And if you've got any data as to, you know, whether the theory is incorrect or not, feel free to chime in. But I feel like for confidence for households who are already been hit by inflation, by rising rates, their confidence levels have already basically collapsed. They're, you know, things are already as, you know, near as dour as they're going to get in relative terms, because there's always that glimmer of hope. And I just wonder if we're just seeing once again that bifurcation of between, you know, different elements of society, whereby some people are still feeling pretty good about things, where others, you know, like you mentioned, people who are, you know, getting ready to pounce on, you know, distressed assets, but then there's the other people who are, well, they're the ones with the distressed assets.
Absolutely. And yes, I can say in my surveys, because I actually do have confidence data in my surveys, I'm seeing that same bifurcation. So the confidence levels are much higher for those without a mortgage and if they own the property outright, et cetera, or more affluent people. The confidence levels are a lot lower for those in the rental sector. They are really, really being taken to the cleaners. And those who've bought recently, first-time buyers, and those in those outer suburban areas in particular where their income is not just insufficient to cover all the standard costs. And interestingly, the other little bit of measuring here is how people are responding. For example, if you look at grocery shopping, around 16% of households have changed their shopping behaviours now, according to my surveys. And a lot of them are now buying smaller, shopping around more specifically to going, you know, to Aldi and local veggie shops rather than actually Coles and Woolies, and have reduced the size of their, you know, weekly shop, 16%, and that's rising quite fast as well. And there's a strong correlation between those who are actually having these issues with the levels of mortgage stress and the low levels of confidence. So you can see how all of these things knit together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, that's something that I've suspected for a while, and I think it's not just in Australia that this is occurring. I think it's also occurring in the US, where, you know, people have already been driven to the wall. And I mean, their inflation is a lot worse than our inflation problem is. I mean, admittedly, we may join them in time at that particular level. But, you know, for example, the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey recently recorded its lowest level since it was started over 70 years ago. So, you know, I feel like we're seeing this not only in Australia, but around the world, and this just really significant split between the have and the have not.
Absolutely right. And yes, you know, there is a lot of similarity between confidence in New Zealand, UK, Australia, US, Canada. I think the other point I want to highlight is that there are some people who are still not fully understanding what's going on. So they've got a bit of a sense that, you know, finances are a bit under pressure, but they're not necessarily done the work to understand how their finances really are, right? And a lot of those are actually in those outer suburban suburbs who they know they've got a bit of a problem, but they don't know how much difficulty they're in. So, for example, if I ask them, do you feel that you've got financial problems. And if I do the math on their households and their budgets, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. It's about half as the people think they've got a problem who have a problem. So that's quite an interesting observation. The other one is that at the top end, some of those households who are pretty confident are still struggling with property investments that aren't performing. So even there, they've got a few issues, but they're more confident because they've got more assets behind them and they've got more options. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not actually dealing with price pressures and property pressures too. So this is a really complicated sort of story, I think, in terms of trying to understand what's going on. And this is going to play out. Our final point to make, you made a very interesting observation. Our inflation is lower. Well, the official number is lower, right? From 2.5 months ago, right? We'll get the next one in due course, right? We don't have monthly snapshots of inflation, right? And we know that the way that the inflation is measured is probably pretty myopic here in Australia too. Certainly, again, in my surveys, the number of households are reporting considerable rises, not just 5.1% or even 6.6%, but a lot more in terms of those basic things they're spending money on, would suggest to me that the true inflation rate is a way higher in Australia even now.
Well, without sort of going off on a long rant about the weightings and the issues of the ABS CPI, I mean, the latest CPI had rental inflation at 1%. I mean, I realise that you're talking about they're measuring total rental stock, whereas SQM or CoreLogic are measuring asking rents, but one is 16%, one is 1%. And, well, you know, you can do the math. You can work out how many properties are for rent at any given time, how many people are facing rental increases. And yeah, I mean, it would, but by the same token, even if you look at the Aussie CPI, right? And I know I may have said, I think I probably have said this before on the show, but for people who haven't heard it before, in the Aussie CPI, alcohol and rent have a very similar weighting. And I mean, it's just that, and that is the only element of the CPI that is actually in any way exposed to the rising cost of housing in terms of rent or in terms of rising housing prices. The rest of the housing component has nothing to do with those things. It only has to do with, and the only thing in terms of like market forces is based on the cost of constructing a new home. So yeah, it's not like the US CPI where 30%, where over 30% of the thing is some form of rent or some form of market sensitive housing price thing. So, you know, I mean, what Australian CPI would look like if with similar US numbers, you know, I don't know.
It'll be a lot higher. And, you know, just bearing in mind the fact that there's a review of the Reserve Bank, of course, now been announced. And one of the things they'll be talking about is inflation targeting. But the question should be, how are you measuring it and are you measuring the right thing? And the other point, of course, it's the rate of change of inflation. So you could still be in the situation where prices have gone up and then stay high but don't continue to rise. So therefore, over time, the inflation number comes down, but the true ongoing costs for real households stay high. That shows you how stupid the numbering is.
No, well, exactly. And that's going to continue to drag on. I mean, I did the math the other day based on pre-COVID levels of wage growth. It's going to be decades before most households catch up if we end up with pre-COVID levels of real wages growth. You know, so that's going to continue to drag on the economy for years and years and years to come. And it's just ridiculous that it's not really something that's being discussed by the government. You know, it's just silly. Mind you, you know, I mean, I still have my tweet up about, you know, Albo not talking about the rental crisis. I'm still waiting for that 2 months later.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just make the other point, of course, that if you compare growth in real wages and growth in real returns to corporates over the last 10 years, right, which of the two has gone up? Well, it's not real wages, but corporate earnings to the moon. And my theory is that some of the inflation that we're now seeing is corporates passing on those higher costs. So corporate profits will be fine, but it's at the expense of consumers again.
Yeah, well, at least until consumers start spending less. I mean, that will eventually occur, but I think it could take longer than is generally anticipated, considering that we are seeing that bifurcation between the affluent and the have-nots.
Yep.
Well, this is, Yeah, well, lowest unemployment rate since 1974. Now, the we can sort of get into things about the RBA's mandate, but it basically comes down to inflation and employment, which I think that's basically what it boils down to. And in my view, the labour market, at least the headline labour market, could stay strong for quite some time to come. You know, we still see strong job ads. I mean, obviously, we can have the debate about, you know, whether or not they're accurate or not. But based on the barometers that we currently have, you know, as you know, taken purely at face value, the labour market could stay strong for quite some time to come. And as we've seen in New Zealand, where the labour market there hasn't been impacted negatively by rising rates and even falling GDP yet. So, you know, rising rates could be a story for a lot longer than a lot of people want to think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And the real interesting observation is it isn't just Australia, right? It's true in New Zealand, it's true in the UK, it's true in the US. The unemployment rate's a lot lower than people expect it to be. But here, you know, is this artificial? I mean, you know, are we measuring it wrong or is it true? There seem to be a lot of people. Basically, they said for every job, there's a worker.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, sort of for the purposes of interest rates, it doesn't really matter because at the end of the day, the RBA is going to go, oh, 3.5%. Well, we can raise interest rates some more. I mean, this chart is in summation the ammunition for Phil Lowe to go full Wile E. Coyote chasing after inflation. Because at the end of the day, you know, as far as he's concerned, as long as people aren't losing their jobs in any significant, I mean, let's just, you know, sort of war game out a scenario at the moment. Even if Phil Lowe decides that pre-COVID unemployment is something that, you know, he doesn't want unemployment to rise fast, and that is when they'll pause raising rates. Unemployment needs to rise by 1.7% to get there. That's going to take quite some time. And it's a lagging indicator as it stands. So, I mean, say like in New Zealand, they haven't seen, you know, any downside in unemployment for 6 months. So, but let's say things are currently deteriorating and going down the toilet and at a great rate of knots. That means we're potentially 18 months away from them cutting rates at best. So, you know, this whole idea that, oh, it's going to be, you know, we're going to be cutting rates real soon and all that, I'm not buying it, not unless something blows up globally.
Mm, well, it could, but I'm of the view that this interest rate problem is going to be a big one for quite some time because, as you say, they're looking at the employment rate, which is, well, ultra low.
Yeah. Well, we got even more housing, this time from the US. Now, in the run-up to the financial crisis, flipping houses, as they called it, which is basically buying a house, fixing it up, and then selling it, was a very, very popular thing. It was, you know, there was television shows about it. It became, you know, the talk of the barbecues in the US in the way that housing really never had been before. Yet there are, as a proportion of total sales, more people are flipping houses today than at the peak of things prior to the financial crisis. And I think that really speaks volumes about where we are in the US housing cycle.
I agree. And interestingly, there are some regional variations that are just worth understanding too, right? Because as with, you know, this market's here, it's not happening the same all over the place, but it looks to me as though it's pretty wobbly. And by the way, also in Canada, Vancouver prices, down. Prices are down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, in the US, prices are still up in aggregate. But as you say, there are places where prices have risen significantly, you know, particularly in some of the smaller, cities, in some of these sort of, more regionally focused states, you've seen prices come down significantly. I mean, there are some, I believe it was some places in Idaho, of all places, you know, sort of, relatively rural, relatively small populations where in some areas, 50% of properties have slashed their prices.
Yep.
Well, 50% of properties on sale, you know, currently listed. And that's really quite a figure considering, you know, these property markets were very, very hot even 12 months ago.
Absolutely. And, you know, the trends, well, people are worried over in the US. I was talking to someone the other day over there who's looking at their property portfolio and it's already dropping in value. And the question is, how much will it drop? And they're sort of going back to the 2007, 2008, 2009 saying, well, the conditions are somewhat similar to what they were then.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's going to be, I mean, obviously they don't have the same issue with, you know, the adjustable rate loans that they had then, but I just think it's just going to take a little bit longer to play out. And it's going to be really interesting to watch, because it could be a key, if we do start to see the US housing market really roll over, that could be something that starts to put some rather significant downward pressure on inflation more broadly.
Yeah, but I think the Fed is fixated on inflation. You know, that's the number one challenge and the number two challenge and the number three challenge, it seems to me. So I don't think they're going to stop anytime soon.
No. I mean, the housing market's going to be a story that's going to play out over multiple years. You know, we haven't even seen the big rollover yet. And, you know, I mean, it's probably, you know, a 2020, 2023, 2024 story, realistically.
Yep.
Okay. The Atlanta Fed GDP forecast. I don't think this has ever been so thoroughly covered by elements of the media than ever before. But basically, it shows that the US GDP in Q2 now is going to basically go down about 1.7% on an annualized level, according to the Atlanta Fed's GDP modeling. Now, I should make it clear that this is not a sort of, shall we say, managed model where the inputs are smoothed, etc. This is very much a mechanical model. It takes various inputs, it then puts them into a computer, and then it spits out this number. But, I mean, it's still not looking good in that regard.
Well, what I quite like, Tarek, is the, you know, blue chip consensus up there somewhere, the data's down here, right? And, and you're right, it's just a data-driven set of algorithms, right? But what it basically says is the rest of it is hopium.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think it's entirely possible that we see, I mean, this is actually quite a contrarian bullish opinion here. So, you know, stop the presses. But, you know, I actually think it's possible that we could see sneak in to get to a zero. Mm. I think that's, I'm not saying necessarily that it's likely, but I'm saying that it's possible, because while falling 1.7% sounds like a lot, that's an annualized figure.
Mm.
And, you know, so realistically it's only about going to go down about 0.4% on a non-annualized basis. So, I mean, if anyone has played GDP bingo before here in Australia or anyone else, seeing a swing of 0.4% isn't out of the ordinary. It's not something that's not commonplace. It happens all the time.
Yeah, it reminds me of my science experiments at school. I used to say, allowing for experimental error, you know, this could be plus or minus 1% or whatever. It's in the rounding, isn't it? This isn't a definitive, but it is indicative. And like I say, there is a gap between the data itself and what the data is actually translated to and what the markets and the blue chips are saying. So it will be interesting how it plays out. And, you know, in a way, I'm almost hoping that the blue chips are right, because if they do go into recession, that's going to put a huge, oh, no, what do I do now sort of question in front of the Fed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's pretty much how I see it too. I mean, I'm really hoping that they just sneak in a zero, even if it's adjusted down later, but just for now, that would be nice, I feel.
Yeah.
Okay, now, there's quite a lot of debate, shall we say, about the US CPI, you know, that it's, you know, sort of mostly driven by energy, that, you know, once the energy issue is addressed, that it's going to come down and that, you know, inflation is going to go away and et cetera. And yes, energy is a huge contributor. It's 2.4% of the 9.1% figure. But as the core inflation number, which strips out those more volatile things, shows, it's still 5.9% once you take all that stuff out of the equation. And even services inflation by itself is 3%. So services inflation by itself would be driving the Fed to hike even now. So I think that inflation could end up being a lot more sticky than the sort of, oh, it's only energy, it's only Ukraine narrative would suggest.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because everybody's sort of blaming everybody else and everything else, right? So, you know, the government's blaming Ukraine, the federal central banks are blaming Ukraine or energy, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody really wants to take responsibility for the mess that's been created, which is interesting. And I have to come back, Tarek, to the point that this inflation thing is really a fallout from the massive quantitative easing that was done in the prior 2 years around COVID, right? And there were early signs, actually, in 2020, and before we get to 2021, that actually they were overheating the economy, right? But they are trying to find lots of excuses as to why it's supply chains that are broken, or it's Russia, Ukraine, or it's energy. Now, those things are there, I agree. But a lot of this inflation was created by bad monetary policy for a number of years. And unfortunately, it should be sheeted back, I think, to the central banks. But the central banks have a wonderful knack of saying...
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen that over the last couple of months, haven't we? I mean, we saw that with Lagarde last night, you know, with... I don't even know what it was. It was a train wreck. And then, you know, there's Powell. And, I mean... But, you know, by the same token, you know, you can point the finger at the RBA, at the Fed, and yeah, they've absolutely screwed things up, well, enormously. But I just look at things like, you know, like people say, like, say here in Australia, it's like, well, the Liberals did a good job. Well, no, they injected $40 billion into the economy, more for JobKeeper that we didn't need. And it's like, well, how much is inflation higher now? How much is consumer spending higher now than it was before? And how much of that could be potentially been driven by JobKeeper? Oh, most of it?
Yep.
Oh, okay. You know, it's like the paycheck, you know, protection program and all this other stuff. You take the dodgy stuff out of that, how much lower would inflation be now?
Plus superannuation withdrawals, plus the term funding facility, right? Which is, of course, still sitting there on the balance sheets of the banks at the central bank, and the central bank is still paying the banks our money for the money that's sitting there. How stupid is that? I mean, we threw money in all the wrong directions, way too much of it. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have reacted firmly at the start when COVID first hit, because it clearly people weren't sure how this was going to play out. But the indications were quite soon that they actually were overstimulating and overheating the economy. They didn't need to do a lot of the stuff they did subsequent, and it became ideological and doctrinal, I think. And this is now we're reaping the whirlwind.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point about it being ideological. I mean, you look at, say, for example, US bond rates, right? The Treasury, you know, that there was issues in the Treasury market, which is basically the, you know, what underpins, you know, the entire global financial system. And when I say the Treasury market, for those who may not be familiar, I'm talking about the US government bond market. Now, yes, there was those issues. There was the issues, you know, with it being, you know, dysfunctional as termed by the Fed and other central banks. But you're literally talking about a couple of days.
Yep.
You know, a couple of days of, I mean, and yes, obviously if they had have just left it and let it implode, it would have been bad. But they literally just could have just said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to fix the Treasury market. You know, we're going to do a little, you know, this program, that program, that program, and then just gone, okay, that's it. Now we're going to leave it alone. You know, we're going to do a little, you know, we're going to, you know, sort of manage it, you know, on the fly. If things get, you know, sort of a bit unreal, a bit, you know, a bit wobbly, we'll step in. But they didn't do that. They kept buying mortgages. They kept buying bonds. They kept driving interest rates lower, and they kept pumping this bubble. And they didn't need to do that. I mean, you know, today the S&P 500 could be at 3,200, you know, even after falling a bit. And it would be in a much better place, and there'd be a lot less people panicking.
Yep.
But now we've seen this sort of massive drawdown in the value of wealth, in the store, you know, the values of bonds, all these different things, and they created that the situation for that to occur.
Yeah, now they broke it. Well, they can't fix it. Basically, is my view, and it is ideological. It was ideological, and it remains so. And the problem I always have with this, Tarek, as we discussed earlier on, it's the ordinary people who end up getting the damp end of the stick, right? It's not the bankers. It's not the 1%. They're all doing fine. But it's ordinary people who, you know, trying to get by, trying to get that mortgage service, all those things. They're the ones that are actually paying for this. And yeah. There's no accountability, you know, at the Reserve Bank or anywhere else, or indeed for the Treasury. I think Treasury needs to take a lot of the responsibility here, because they were pulling those levers and persuading people to do things too. The only point to make is everyone was talking the same story, but that's because, of course, central bankers were talking to each other via the Bank for International Settlement. And, you know, there was this sort of common, I'm going to say collusion, this common approach that was actually being wheeled out, right? But the bottom line is we overstimulated the economy. Now we're actually reaping the whirlwind, And this is going to be painful to unpick one way or the other. And unfortunately, some of the people who made the decisions are still in positions of power. And they have shown no remorse at all.
No, no, and I doubt they will, unfortunately. But I see that we've run quite long, so I'll get to the next slide. Another slide that largely speaks for itself. Basically, there's been a lot of debate over time over inflation, over what would inflation look like if it was calculated in the same way as it was back in the 70s or back in the 80s. And what the National Bureau of Economic Research in the US has put together is a model that calculates inflation in the 1970s and the 1980s using the same methodology and the same weightings as today. Now, if you then extrapolate today's inflation rate onto the way things were back at the peak, the very peak of the original oil crisis in December 1974, inflation is slightly higher now. And I think that really rams home beautifully how big of a mistake the Fed has made, and just what the degree of challenges we now face getting inflation back towards that 2% target band. Because I mean, even if you look at this, for example, it from that peak in inflation, it was the better part of a decade before it went back to 2%. So, I mean, how long is it going to take us this time? I mean, I don't think it's going to take anywhere near that long if we sort of, you know, see like a major meltdown. But, you know, how long is that going to take?
Could easily be 2 or 3 years, I think, before things begin to normalize. And that's only if sensible decisions are taken. The risk is that they don't make those sensible decisions and they basically pull the lever really hard one way and then, oh, no, we're going to hit, you know, recession. And they pull the lever back the other way and we get ultra low interest rates. And then, you know, the more of the roller coaster up and down. I mean, that's more, I think, the scenario I'm looking at the moment.
Yeah, well, it's like the yo-yo we talked about before, you know. It's like, oh, we've killed inflation sufficiently. Oh, we're going to do some stimulus. Oh, inflation's back again, and we're about right back where we started.
Exactly.
Speaking of inflation, US, according to the Federal Reserve's wage tracker, wage inflation is currently at its highest level since the series began in the mid-1990s, at almost 7% on a three-month annualized basis. And I think that really, you know, I think it was Rabobank came out the other day and they said that basically this is showing that, you know, if these pressures continue for much longer, that we are going to see a wage spiral embedded in the US economy because unemployment's low, these workers have leverage, and they're getting smashed by inflation and that they're going to demand higher wages to make up for that.
And just to reemphasize, what we're saying is that in real wages terms, they're still going backwards.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, inflation's what, 9 or something. And I agree with you. And of course, everyone, you know, central bankers were worrying about the, if people start asking for big wage rises, it's going to actually embed inflation and it's, you know, it's going to actually continue to spiral, which is precisely what happened back then a few decades ago when we had the same inflationary problem. And it's interesting that in the UK, there are people striking now for stronger wages. And, you know, people even here in Australia are talking about, well, you know, we don't want to be left behind. The truth is, real wages have gone nowhere in more than a decade. Here, in the US, in the UK, and in New Zealand. So people are actually worse off than they were then, if you're the average worker, right? Now, of course, the 1% not really well, not everybody else. And if this gets embedded, they will find it really difficult to actually deal with inflation.
Yeah, well, because then they're stuck. I mean, you know, people can say, you know, they'll just abandon inflation. It's like, well, I think that it's sort of, you know, maybe sort of putting the cart before the horse, so to speak, just in the sense that part of the reason why the Fed is hiking aggressively now is because bond rates did take off the way they did at the start of the year when the bond market finally spat the dummy and had enough of the transitory inflation narrative. So if they do decide to walk away from inflation and they do decide to just say, oh, no, don't worry about it, the bond market's going to spit the dummy all over again, and then we're just going to have the same problem.
Absolutely, yeah. Volatility ahead is my forecast for what's going to happen.
Well, that's a nice easy one, I reckon. This is an interesting one, and it leads into the slide after as well. And basically, it shows that the amount of floor space currently under construction in China on a year-on-year basis has basically collapsed below the levels of, 2020, below the various downturns in China in 2012. And it just goes to show what, this is, I think, a really, really nice barometer of what's going on in the property sector, that, that these projects are getting approved, but the capital just isn't there to actually really kick on with them.
No, well, I did a show yesterday about the mortgage strikes, which, of course, is the other corollary of this, right? A lot of people basically aren't seeing their properties being completed, and they've now gone on strike in a number of Chinese cities. And also, of course, there was this other deposit scam where basically deposits were suddenly converted to investments, which they couldn't then withdraw. So the financial system in China is really creaking. The cornerstone is the property. That's created the problem. But it's contaminated the broader financial markets now as well, and the financial system. Important analogy for Australia. So much of the Australian market is linked to what happens in property. And, my argument is, if property prices fall the way we think they're going to, and we get the mortgage delinquencies and things that we expect to see, this could have a fallout, not just in the property sector, but in the financial system more broadly, and the banks in particular.
Yeah, I agree. And we've actually got the mortgage strike on the next slide.
Hey.
Yeah.
Great monster delight.
Yeah, indeed. And this is the last one for today. In one Chinese locale, they have already put in place a bailout fund for property developers so that these projects can get completed where people have stopped paying their mortgage, because they are very, very concerned about what could happen to some of these local banks who are, they're in a rather bad way. And we've got the one on the right there from Time Magazine, where economists and commentators are warning that this could spread into a wider contagion if more people stop paying their mortgages because of these stoppages in construction. I mean, there was an analysis by Reuters the other day that suggested that there could be up to $220 billion worth of projects that are currently on hold, where people could stop paying their mortgages, and that could be a rather sizable hit to these local little banks who are already well and truly overstretched due to COVID and all the other stuff that's transpired over in China over the last couple of years in terms of the property sector.
Well, there's a bit of circularity there too, isn't it? Because a lot of those banks are actually connected to the land and the developers. It's a bit of a circular argument, right, as to who's got the parcel.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's part of the problem as well. Like, there's this idea, like, say, for example, recently the Chinese government came out and said, oh, we're going to spend $200 billion in infrastructure. It's going to be done by front-loading local government special bonds, that are meant for 2023 that we're going to do with the latter half of 2022 instead. But it's all the funds are going to flow to local governments. Local governments, meanwhile, many of them are up the creek without a paddle in terms of debt, because they've seen land sales, which in aggregate drive 40% of local government revenue, fall off a cliff. So it's like, well, I wonder where some of that money might end up.
Yeah, yeah. It just shows you how that circularity. It's funny how all of those political types and, the guys calling the shots seem to end up okay.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, I think that that's going to be something that we're going to see over, something interesting we're going to see over the next couple of years in China, just in the sense that, like, the system is creaking. I don't think we're seeing like the sort of absolute peak of resources being expended, but we're seeing cracks begin to appear. Where a couple of years ago, if a state-owned enterprise got into trouble, they just threw money at it till the problem went away. That's not happening anymore. You're seeing more and more bond defaults. You're seeing more and more local governments getting into trouble, turning to all sorts of wacky things like selling themselves their own land to financing vehicles that are then backed by either Beijing or by their own credit. So it's this weird, once you're in, like you said, this giant circular thing. But, you're starting to see these stresses. And I mean, like, say, for example, like those borrowers who all protested at these local banks, these banks that got into trouble. A couple of years ago, they would have just thrown money at them. They would have just, like, just here's the money, go away. But they don't have the money now to be able to just bail out everyone willy-nilly. And I think that's a real sign of weakness and stress for the Chinese system.
No, I agree. And, more broadly, it's very interesting how the theme, I think, of today is really you know, the bifurcation in the economies, you know, here and there. And there are some people doing really well, and there are some people who will always do really well, and there are others who won't. And I guess, you know, the archetypal example would be Mr. Frydenberg, right, who's managed to roll straight into the banking sector, right? I mean, you know, almost immediately. How does that work?
Well, I mean, maybe he's like a cat. He lands on his feet, you know, like it's – but I mean, I guess, you know, he was the director of global banking of Deutsche before he was a liberal politician as well. So, I mean, into the banking system, out of university, into politics, and then back into the banking sector. So, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, it's just, you know, the default setting. But I mean, it is a little bit, I mean, I don't know, like, you know, Cameron Murray said on Twitter the other day that, you know, there should be a cooling off period whereby, you know, people shouldn't be able to just go as, you know, from being the federal treasurer to working for Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Or someone like Andrew Robb shouldn't be able to go from leasing the port of Darwin to a Chinese company to working for a Chinese company that was linked to the people who leased the port. So, you know, yeah. I mean,
It's the old saying, isn't it? One rule for them and one rule for everybody else. And that's true whether you look at it economically, whether you look at it socially or politically. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be such a level playing field as perhaps people would like to see.
People, I mean, I spent a lot of time growing up in the developing world, you know, because that's where my family is from. And People say to me, oh, well, there's no corruption or there's no dodginess in our government like there is there. And I just go, really? Really? Have you not turned on the news recently?
Yeah, it is institutionalized and it's accepted. And, of course, the old adage is it's not actually, you know, corruption itself, but it's actually getting found out that's the problem in Australia. I remember somebody years ago, before I came to Australia, said, superficially, you'll think Australia is very like the UK, right? But actually, just be aware that there's a different set of rules below the surface, right? I now understand more about what they were saying, because it does seem to me that if you're actually in a particular section of society, society will look after you and, you know, everything will be fine and whatever happens, you'll be fine. But I come back to this point about the average Australian, the average small business owner, you know, the average property owner or the average renter. They're actually, many of them are really up against it now because of bad policy decisions taken over 20 years and particularly the last 2 years. And unfortunately, nobody's really looking after them. Nobody's got their backs, not even the politicians, they might say. That's the problem that Australia has.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's rather frustrating when you think about it, just in the sense that in Australia, we do have these protected species. You know, you look at, you know, say, for example, certain developers, builders, etc., you know, they're just like, oh, well, you know, the government has to intervene. The government has to, you know, if not X, Y, and Z is going to happen. You know, and that doesn't exist for the vast majority of Australians. You know, like it's a case of, oh, hey, bad luck, you know, to much of the rest of us. I mean, like, say, like the arts sector. You know, during COVID or the university sector, it was like, oh, well, too bad. But, you know, if it was the construction sector, which with all of its, you know, 12% of the, what is it, 12% of the labor force that are part of or directly linked to. Yep. So like, what's that? 1 in 8. But, you know, if it's the construction sector with its 1 in 8 jobs, all of a sudden, you know, well, we better do something about that.
I know. Yeah. Well, you've got to be in the right lane. Clearly, that's the problem. I've never been in the right lane.
No, neither have I. All this, you know, all this money falling out of the sky. Somehow I find a way for it not to land on me.
Exactly. Yeah, we should write to somebody.
Oh, there, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I haven't been so successful with my letter writing, I must say.
Well, Tarek, you may not be successful with your letter writing, but you do some great work on the slides. Thank you very much for that. Great to chat with you again. Really appreciate your perspective as well, as always. Links and things below, and go to Substack to get the slides if you want to look in more detail. And we'll do it all again in a couple of weeks, eh?
Yeah, sounds good, mate. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about.
I'm sure there will. Take care. See you later. Bye.
See you later, mate. Bye.